From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Beekeeping is a thing in recent years, an increasingly popular hobby, but our relationship with honeybees goes back much further to one we had as early human hunter-gatherers following wild bees in hope of finding their hives and the honey therein. This history and the subject of bee lining, the other way to connect to honeybees besides keeping hives, is the subject of the new book called Following the Wild Bees, The Craft and Science of Bee Hunting by Cornell University biologist Thomas Seeley. And he's my guest today, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden. Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Thomas Seeley is the Horace White Professor in Biology in the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell. He's been passionately interested in honeybees since high school, eventually doing his doctoral thesis on them, and his scientific work since has primarily focused on understanding the phenomenon of swarm intelligence with the help of these incredible animals. I welcome him to the program today. It's so nice to have the opportunity to speak to you, Tom.
Good afternoon, Margaret. My pleasure to be with you.
Yes. So before your new book, I'd only read about the subject of bee hunting or bee lining, I think twice, in Bernd Heinrich's book, The Homing Instinct, and then in a much older work by the late 19th or early 20th century New York State naturalist John Burroughs. And
yes.
I think you mentioned both of them in the book, but I think you first got excited about bee hunting from a little vintage book about the subject by a Harvard professor, maybe?
Yes, that's right. Harold S. Edgell.
Yes.
And he was a very well-educated man. He was a professor of architectural history at Harvard and became the director of the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. So he was a very distinguished gentleman. But his favorite pastime was bee hunting, or sometimes called bee lining.
Yeah.
And he learned his craft from an old-timer from the Adirondacks, northern New York State, who, I think he said in his book, had fallen into the situation of taking care of his father's mules up in Newport, New Hampshire. So the old-timer knew this craft, and Edgell picked it up, and it was probably the most pleasurable thing he did in his life when he went bee hunting.
So this little book of yours maybe will be a book that can inspire people to carry on in that tradition. So as I said in the introduction, it's likely that we've been intently connected to the honeybee since early human hunter-gatherers hunted them. So can you give us a little perspective about, you know, how did honeybees get here anyway, and how old is our relationship with them, things like that?
Certainly, and that's a great topic to set the stage for if we want to talk more in detail about the bee hunting method.
Yes.
Yes. Historically, humans, which arose in Africa and spread, of course, to Europe and Asia, historically, honey was the only really super sweet that people had. Later on, they had dates, and that became an important source of sweetness, too, like for the Egyptians. But honey has always been the premium source of sweetness for humans. And we know that our closest ancestors, the chimpanzees, the gorillas, the orangutans, the bonobos, they all like honey. So it's very likely that even the proto-humans and our ancestors now, we know Homo sapiens dates back 300,000 years. We know from the fossils, probably 300,000 years ago, primitive Homo sapiens were honey hunting, driven by the lure of the sweetness.
I love that. Now, honeybees don't come from America. They're not a native bee species, right?
Correct. They were, Apis mellifera was introduced to North America. The earliest records are, 1640, English, brought in from England, and to the Virginia colonies, and next one was to the Massachusetts Bay Colony. I think that was a few years later.
And were they from England and Europe, or where were they from? Is that their native habitat?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. Those first imports came from England.
Okay.
And they were, to the bee specialists, they were the Northern European dark bee, Apis mellifera mellifera.
Mm. And going fast forward a long way from the mm-hmm. the early man that you just spoke about, we've also been, quote, keeping bees, not just hunting them, but sort of keeping bees, right, for a long time, haven't we?
Yes, yes. The earliest record we have of beekeeping is 4,500 years ago. It's a sculpture in that was found in a temple, Egyptian temple, to the sun god Re, and it depicts a very sophisticated beekeeping operation. There are clay pipes from which one man is extracting honeycombs, and then we see people filling pots with honey, and then another individual is sealing up the pots, putting probably some sort of seal on it to show that it's official.
Huh.
And so that goes back 4,500 years. But the point is, these people, these Egyptians, 4,500 years ago, knew a lot about beekeeping. So clearly, the roots of beekeeping go back well before that.
Yeah. I think in the book you say there's one sentence that's really struck me. You said, it's a remarkable fact that humans have been keeping bees for at least 9,000 years. I guess longer than that. They said starting in the Middle East, and yet this insect still remains an essentially wild animal, even mm-hmm. today. And yep. you're a beekeeper yourself, as well as studying
yeah.
bees. Yeah. So it's still a wild animal?
Yeah. I like to think of it as a wild animal because primarily because even though humans now keep colonies of bees in hives, we still don't have much control over their breeding, and that's because the mating of the queens and the drones occurs outside the hive in the air. So even where the beekeeper's got his or her hives, when a new queen comes into a colony, it goes out and mates with males from any of the colonies in the area. And at least in New York State, there are many more wild colonies than there are managed colonies.
Mm.
So the genetics of honeybees is still being strongly selected by nature, natural selection, and that's still in the colonies that are kept by beekeepers. And any beekeeper knows that. They will know that they can capture a swarm out of the wild, and it will behave just like the bees they would buy if they bought a queen from a queen producer in Georgia or California.
So interesting.
And it's a lot like, you know, there are ponies. You know, they're horses. They're wild horses that just go out and breed on their own, and nobody really takes care of them. Well, we've got that same situation with honeybees. We've got colonies that we manage, like people keep horses, but there are also wild colonies
yes.
that aren't getting care from anybody. And the genetics are really the same, both the managed and the ones free living out in the woods.
So early on, we would go hunting for a tree that had, or another structure that had bees in it, and we would take that sweetness. And then I think you say in the book around 200 AD, European men started the shift from hunting the wild bees to keeping bees. So even the keeping of bees in the more formal sense, I mean, not just going out and finding them, is that?
Yes, the first step was went as follows. People would, and this would be in Northern Europe or Europe, would be locating a colony of bees in a tree, and instead of just cutting down the tree and splitting it open and pulling out the honey, the bee hunter would cut out the section of the tree containing the bees and bring it back to their farm or wherever so they could then harvest honey from it repeatedly by taking the top off or doing some way to get inside.
Hmm. You also write that they have a brain smaller than a grass seed, these honeybees, and yet they're totally self-sufficient. So tell us a little bit, like how many bees are in a colony or hive, whether managed or wild, and who's who, kind of what's a little bit of that, what goes on?
Okay, the basic composition of a colony of bees is that there's one mother queen bee. A colony of bees, I should say, is a family, and the queen is the mother of everybody, and she produces daughters, and most of those daughters are workers. They do not reproduce. They do not lay eggs, and the queen also has sons, known as drones, and most of the time, there's in a colony, there would be one queen bee, and during the height of summer, there might be 20,000 worker bees and maybe 1,000 or so drones. And so that's the family. And all of those daughters, those worker daughters, they do not reproduce themselves. Instead, they work. So they're aptly named. Their work they do is all the work that maintains the colony, building the combs, collecting the food, rearing the young bees, keeping the nest clean, defending the nest, and so forth. The drones, well, they are... they're really their only function is to mate with young virgin queens from neighboring colonies. So, but they're very important because you need fertilization you need sperm in any species.
And it keeps the genetics kind of good too, doesn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. It was interesting because at first it stopped me in the book. You would be describing one of these foraging bees or one of the food storing the bees. Mm-hmm. The forager would come back to the hive and bring some sweetness, and it would be stored by a store. You kept using the pronoun she, and at first it threw me, and then I thought, of course, they are all females.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, right. And it's funny, though.
Yep. I have ovaries.
Yeah, it's funny because you don't really think, you know, I'm not an entomologist, I'm a layperson with a little bit of knowledge, and so, but it threw me, but yeah.
That's perfectly understandable. In the old time bee hunters, they often called the bees they were working with he's, because that's what they thought, you know, those are the bees that were going out and doing the hard work, so they thought that was nice.
Yeah, so take us on a little bit of like a hunt. So here you are, modern day, and not a scientist as well as a modern day human, and you learned about over the last several decades about bee lining or bee hunting. So what, when we want to find out where a wild colony is, what do we do? How does a hunt work?
Let's see. Here's how a hunt works. First, you get together some equipment, and it's very simple. It's like five or six things. One is a little device that a bee hunter calls a bee box. It's just a contraption. It's kind of like a miniature shoebox. It lets you use it to capture some bees inside the box, and then you're going to put in the box to get the hunt started. You're going to put in a square of old a comb from a beehive, and you put sugar syrup in that.
Mm.
Basically, so this bee box is a way to introduce bees that you've captured in the box off of flowers, introduce them to the world's best food source. and you're doing that because you want to get those bees to come to your little feeding station with that comb, and make trip after trip after trip to your feeding station, and every time they fly away, you then have an opportunity to see the direction they're flying.
Right.
And also, if you mark some of those bees you've caught, you can then, with a dot of paint or fingernail polish or whatever, you can then time how long it takes her to go away and come back to your feeder. And with that information, you can start the hunt. You'll know general direction they're coming from and the general distance to their home. That's how you start the hunt.
And you know how fast bees could potentially fly, and you know from your expertise, you layer in factors like I think that you explain in the book about the usual drop-off time, the time spent for like a forager spending back in the hive to drop off her goodies is a certain, you know, so you can make those calculations and say, hey, I think it's about a half a mile away and it's in that general direction.
Yes, that's right. So, the time is a pretty good accurate indicator, the round trip time, the time spent away, going home, offloading the load of sugar solution that she's collected from your comb, and then flying back to the feeder to get more. You can translate that in quite with considerable precision to a distance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but it's a little tricky to do that if you did it from first principles, you might say, because when a bee flies home, she's laden with the nectar she's picked up, and that can be nearly the body weight of her own body when she's empty. So she flies home slowly, but then when she has offloaded and is headed back to your feeding station, your little gold mine for her, she flies quickly. But yeah, in the book I have a little chart that shows for so much time spent away, that corresponds to a given distance to the home base.
One thing that can happen, and there was a funny word in the book too, recruits, that there may mm-hmm. there may be recruits, other bees who learn about this goodness that you've put out in this little enticement in the bee box, and that she may go home, this forager, she may go home and not say, but indicate with a waggle dance? Does she do a dance? Does she show them where there's goodness to be found? Or how does that communication work?
She does. The successful and excited forager does go into the nest, and in addition to offloading the nectar or sugar syrup that she's brought home, she'll perform a dance which indicates the direction and the distance to this wonderful food source that she's just found and exploited. And and you can visualize that if you know the right direction to go and you know how far to go, that will take you to the right location. And that's what the bees do. They have this waggle dance whereby one bee can tell another bee which direction to find a rich food source and how far to travel in that direction.
It's amazing. It it gives me the chills still just thinking about it, really.
And that's actually a very appropriate response, because there's only one other species on this planet that can give directions in that manner, abstractly, by saying, well, here's the direction and here's the distance you go. Not by leading the individual to the site.
Right.
Or leaving markers or something like that, but doing it abstractly. And that other species, is, of course, us. So bees and human beings are unique.
Wow.
They have a shared uniqueness.
Ah, I love it. So you, as a bee hunter, you hope to... the grail for you, you're not going there to get the honey. You're not going to, and this is a spoiler alert, the last chapter, I think, is called On Not Taking Up the Bee Tree, meaning cutting down the bee tree, not plundering the tree. So you're going, tell us why. I mean, moments like what the knowledge of things like the complexity of their communication and all this magic that's miracles that are going on would be enough for me. But tell us what you're going out looking for and why.
I go out and do this bee hunting and locating the wild colonies, tree homes, nests in the hollow trees. I do it for two reasons. One is that sometimes I need to find colonies for my investigations where I'm just tracking the survivorship and things like that of wild colonies. So I will use bee hunting to line up a group of study colonies. The other reason I do bee hunting, though, is not it's not professional. It's just personal. It's fun. It's a pastime. And it's a lot like geocaching in that there's a very specific destination you're trying to locate, and you're getting directions, you're getting guidance, but you're not getting it from another human being giving you clues or something on your smartphone, but is by getting your information from another species in a more mysterious manner by watching, trailing them home. And so it's a pastime, it's a challenge, it's a form of hunting, and I don't think I'm unusual that I think we're really kind of thrilled to go hunting for things.
Yes.
And so it's a lot of fun. It's also a real challenge, and it has if you're a beekeeper, if you're a bee aficionado, it's a great way to actually look at the behavior of individual bees. And let me explain a little bit about that. When a beekeeper sees bees, it's usually he or she is usually looking at hundreds, if not thousands, of bees in front of, just sitting there in front of him or herself, because he or she's opened the hive, and you've got all these bees, and they're anonymous, and they're running around, and your attention isn't on an individual. When you're bee hunting, you've got the bees labeled with paint marks or whatever for individual identification, so you can get those measurements of the time spent away. And now it gets very personal, and you learn that, oh, different bees behave differently. Some are rather calm and just go about their business, and others are like quite nervous. They don't, when they come back, they hesitate to land. If anything, if you move the paintbrush near them, they're jumpy. So you get to learn the individuality of bees. Mm-hmm. And I guess the other thing that's really nice about bee hunting, or at least a big attraction for many, is that it takes you to places you'd never otherwise go. If you like nature, you'll often find places that, you never knew. Wow, there's a waterfall over here, or there's a stream, a really beautiful part of a forest. And so that's another feature of it. And plus, you're just out in nature.
Yeah,
it's a great excuse to be out in nature.
In the last couple of minutes, I wanted to ask about where the bees might lead you, where these hives might be located, because I was very surprised at some of the photographs in the book, which were marked to indicate where in the picture the hive was. They weren't always up high in a big old tree. What kinds of places have you found hives in?
As a rule, they are not in the tippy top of a tree, but rarely are they less than 20 feet off the ground.
Uh-huh.
Bees, when they choose a home, they seem to go high, prefer high. That's probably for safety from bears. Bears don't have great eyesight, so and in my experience is in forests, that if a nest is high off the ground, the bears don't find it. If it's low to the ground, the bears do find it.
Yes.
So I think the bees are going high, but they like the entrance to the knot hole. Usually it's a knot hole entrance. Usually they like it to be on the south side of the tree, the sunny side of the tree. And they don't have, however, any preference with respect to the tree type.
Oh.
But inside that knot hole, they are quite choosy. They like they need the nest cavity to be about at least about 10 gallons in volume, or 40 liters.
Wow.
So they're choosy about the entrance size, entrance direction, cavity size. There may be other things like the thickness of the walls. They may be judging that as well, but we're not sure on that.
Some subjects for further exploration.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah. There's so much about any species that we don't.
Yes.
It's mysterious.
Well, Tom Seeley, I was so glad to receive the book from Princeton University Press and to read it and to have a chance to talk to you. So thank you so much for making time.
Well, thank you for your interest in the book. You don't have to be a bee hunter to enjoy bee hunting. I enjoyed it so much, I figured, I'll write this book and explain not only how it works, but why it works, what we know about the bees' behavior that makes this whole bee hunting process work.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com. Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/AwayToGarden.
Thanks to all of you for listening to Now Don't Miss an Episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. Find me anytime at AwayToGarden.com or at Facebook or Instagram as @AwayToGarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.